All right, our next case for argument is 25-1659, Optima Tech versus Maxell. Counsel, how do I say your name?
McPhail, Don McPhail.
Mr. McPhail, please proceed.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. Don McPhail of Merchant and Gould on behalf of Optima Technology. The first point I would like to address today is actually the third point we've raised in our brief, which is that the district court abused its discretion here by dismissing the case and instead of simply staying it until the Texas case played itself out.
Well, counsel, what support do you have for saying there would be an abuse of discretion to dismiss without prejudice in lieu of staying?
Because we lost our original filing date. And if we have to go back now and refile this case, we're going to go back to the beginning of the line. And so we're going to lose that time that would have gotten us a faster trial date here.
Do you have a case to support up that it is literally an abuse of discretion to dismiss without prejudice rather than stay?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor. I apologize. No.
Anywhere. I mean, I don't even need it off the top of your head. Do you have it? If I went and looked somewhere,
I would have to go look for that. I do not have anything with me, Your Honor. Okay. I'm sorry.
What's the status of the Texas case? Isn't it about to be tried?
There is not a trial date scheduled yet. We have had the pretrial conference, but there's still not a trial date scheduled in that case.
So in the context of that procedural posture where the Texas case is soon to be tried, what relief – help me understand, practically speaking, what relief you're asking for and why it matters.
Sure, because circumstances have changed. Of the patents that were originally brought in Texas, two of them have been dropped. And that's the 388 and the 988, both of which were at issue in California. So there's not going to be an opportunity for even Optima's sister companies now to get a resolution on the 388 and the 988 patents. They're no longer pending in Texas. They're not going to be tried.
So let's say the Texas case is over and you try – the dismissal was without prejudice, so couldn't you – bring your case again, asserting those patents that had not been raised or asserted in the Texas case?
Theoretically, but as I noted, I think there's two issues there. One is the loss of time, right? We're going to go back to the beginning of the line in California. It's going to take us even longer before we get a trial date. Whereas if we're entitled...
What's going to happen now?
No, we will be entitled to a trial date based on our original filing date. And I suspect the court would treat it as expeditiously because we are now a long pending case that has been around for a while. But second, and I think more importantly, at the time we filed in district court in California, we had good argument for declaratory judgment action. Why? The 388 and the 988 were being actively enforced against us. If we do this now, they're going to make the argument that there's no DJ jurisdiction anymore. They dropped the 388 and the 988 against sister companies. They're not asserting them against the manufacturer anymore. So they're going to argue that we don't have jurisdiction anymore. And we're now going to have to make that fight. If we look at the jurisdiction at the time the original case was filed, we don't have that fight. It's a slam dunk. We're entitled to a DJ action.
Is your concern that after the Texas case is done, they're going to come after you on those two patents?
Absolutely. This is a long fight between the two. The case in Texas is not the only one.
Why did they drop those patents against the sister company?
You'd have to ask them. Okay. I do not know. And they dismissed without prejudice, so they certainly can bring them again if they choose to. And like I said, this is a long war between these two companies. The Texas case is not the only one that's going on. In addition to the California DJ, there's another DJ action now pending on what we'll call the 142 patent, which is a patent that Maxell has gone to Amazon and asserted at Amazon against Optima Technology. So this is not a case of where we think it's one and done in Texas.
You have a really, really steep climb on getting us to find the abuse discretion by dismissing rather than staying. So can I get you to pivot in the limited time we have today to your other argument for me?
Yes, ma'am. I certainly think that this is a case of all cases where there should have been an exception to the first-to-file rule.
Can I get you to wind back and just actually start with whose law ought to govern the first-to-file rule? Is it your view that that is a kind of question we look at regional circuit law to govern, or do we look at federal circuit law to govern that question? And please tell me why.
I think, as we pointed out in our brief, the federal circuit has not liked California or the Ninth Circuit's view of the first-to-file rule. You have, in the past, this court has found that test to be too rigid.
That's not my question. My question is whether I like them, not whether I like them or not. It's irrelevant whether I like them. The question is who gets to decide, right? Is it federal circuit law? You know, Biodex, Panduit, you're familiar with these cases?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. So we have case law that sets out different procedural issues that are sometimes for us to make procedural rules on. And then the everyday normal type procedural issues, we defer to regional circuit law on so that the district court isn't in this weird scenario of trying to figure out, you know, serve two masters at the same time kind of thing. Sorry. But anyway, so my question for you is this in the Panduit Biodex bucket where this should be a matter of federal circuit law, or is it in the regional circuit law bucket procedurally?
I believe we argued in our brief that it should be a federal circuit law issue. But to be honest with you, I don't think it makes a difference here. Even if you apply the strict Ninth Circuit test, I think we're entitled to one of the exceptions that rises in the first to file rule. Okay? This is a case where Optima Technology is, if not an essential party, certainly a desirable party.
Okay. I hear you're giving me an alternate way, but I still want to know that threshold issue of whose law ought to apply here. And maybe you're arguing, because the only reason I want to know is you started by saying the Federal Circuit doesn't like the Ninth Circuit law. And so, that would suggest that if it's my law that applies, I might come to a different conclusion. But now you just pivoted and said, well, even under the Ninth Circuit law, we win. So I'm back at that threshold, trying to figure out, is this an issue unique to patent law or that has patent law concepts intertwined in it in a way that ought to make it something that we issue a precedential opinion saying, here is the Federal Circuit's law regarding this first-to-file rule and whatever exceptions may or may not apply? Or should we continue to, or should we defer to regional circuits on this point? I still don't have that figured out.
I would propose that it should be a federal circuit decision.
Why, though?
Because it is dependent upon the patent law. There's issues, there's differing questions when it comes to direct and indirect infringement. And that's what really matters here. Optima Technology is the direct infringer in Texas. The sister companies don't do anything in the United States. They've committed no acts in the United States. Maxell is trying to get direct infringement in Texas by arguing that Optima Tech is the agent or alter ego of the Taiwanese company.
So what you're saying is these questions of who ought to be sued are so inextricably intertwined with patent law questions that that ought to be the kind of thing that morphs this otherwise procedural question from regional circuit law into federal circuit law?
Yes, ma'am.
But how is that the case when issues of secondary liability, alter ego, these are all concepts that are extend outside of patent law? They apply in lots of cases that have nothing to do with patents.
Alter ego, yes, sir, correct. But in terms of direct and indirect infringement, those are unique to patent law. Those are questions that only arise in patent law.
Well, aren't there analogs outside of patent law? For instance, aiding and abetting liability, conspiracy liability, things like
copyright.
They come up a lot.
Certainly there are analogies to that, but I look to the specific cases from this circuit, which is that patent law is, to my mind, unique in that respect. I'm not a copyright lawyer. I'm not an insurance lawyer or anything like that. But to me, the issues when it comes to direct and indirect infringement and what goes along with that, the requirement for knowledge for indirect infringement and no knowledge for direct infringement, that sort of thing really makes it unique to patent law. That's not something that really comes up in other contexts.
And getting back to what you said in this case, practically speaking, distinction does not matter.
I don't think it does because I think one of the exceptions should apply here. If it's not the essential party exception, then it's the forum shopping exception.
All right. And the district court here did not say that the exceptions would not apply, but the district court deferred to the Texas court to determine whether any of those exceptions would apply in the first instance, right?
Yes. And we've never gotten a decision from the Texas court on that.
Right.
That's never happened.
In terms of the application of the rule by the district court did not ignore those exceptions. The district court acknowledged them and said that under prior law, the appropriate forum to have those issues raised would be the Texas court, which, by the way, would be in the best position to determine if there was any forum shopping, right? I mean, and in that vein, we have a case that's about to go to trial. Theoretically, they have a basis for having brought that case against the parties that they brought the case against.
Given the facts of this case, I think any court could determine there's forum shopping here. It's a Japanese company against a Taiwanese company. No one has any relationship to Texas. The only relationship to California is Optima Technology because that's where they are. Other than that, this case could have gone anywhere in the United States. It went to East Texas because that's where Maxell thinks they're going to get a good result.
Counsel, how did the district court abuse its discretion with respect to application of the first to file rule?
In this case, I think it was just an abuse of discretion not to apply one of the exceptions. Again, I think Optima Technology is an essential party here, and I do think there is evidence of forum shopping. So that's really where we think the error was here. in not admitting that there was one of the exceptions to, even if you want to say the first to file rule applies under the Ninth Circuit standards, one of those exceptions should have applied here.
Okay, so those exceptions, I mean, so abuse of discretion, right, is clear error for facts and de novo for law. So are there, is it a fact finding that you think the district court made with regard to those two exceptions, which is wrong, or is it part of the legal premise?
I think she erred in not finding that Optima Technology was at least a desirable party, if not an essential party to the case.
Is that a fact question or a law question?
That is a fact question.
Okay, why don't we save some time for rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yep. Mr. Pincus.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing the action under the first to file rule. It made two determinations. First of all, that the doctrine applies here, and then that it was appropriate for the first filed forum to determine whether any exceptions applied. And those, both of those determinations would be reviewed under an abuse of discretion. I heard my friend say they don't dispute that the first to file rule applies, so the only question is the exceptions and whether the district court abused its discretion in concluding that it would leave those questions to be decided by the first filed forum. This court in Future Way has said that that's something that a district court can do. It was
Let me understand how that makes sense in this context, because Optima was only a party in the California litigation. They were not in the Texas case. So, and all they want is for the California litigation to at the very least be stayed, but they wanted it at that time to be moved forward. So how does it make sense for the Texas court to decide whether the second action in California moves forward, you know, involving a party that's not even in Texas?
Well, I think it made sense. First of all, the parent of Optum USA was a party in Texas. And the reason the first to file rule applied in the first place was the district court's conclusion that the parent would protect Optum USA's interests in the Texas litigation. But even more than that, the issues on which Optum USA relies, the desirable, necessary or desirable party issue and the forum shopping issue, were the facts underlying those arguments were before the district court on the motion to transfer, because the argument that my friend makes about, or that are made in the papers about why California, why Optima USA was a desirable party, are all about whether discovery and witnesses and information would be necessary to be obtained from Optima USA. But the district court in applying the motion to transfer factors looked at convenience of the party and in concluded, and I'm quoting from page 7 of the district court's, Texas court's denial of the motion to transfer, the fact that most of the disputed issues will turn on evidence and testimony that will come from defendants rather than their affiliates or customers significantly undermine defendants' transfer request. In other words, what the district court concluded is because the manufacturer was before the Texas court, the idea that Optima USA was so desirable that the case should be transferred didn't make any sense because most of the evidence was going to come from the manufacturer with respect to the patent and infringement. And also the district, the Texas court found, Optima USA's other argument was, well, it had all the information about imports into the U.S., but the Texas court also found in connection with the motion to transfer that there were other customers that were importing the goods into the U.S. as alleged in the complaint. And so Optima USA wasn't a sort of a desirable party on that basis. Also, on the forum shopping issue, the arguments that were made in California were that these were, as you heard, these are Japanese patents, Japanese companies, no reason for them to be in Texas. The district court looked at those arguments and concluded that there was no reason to be in California. It pointed to Maxell's evidence that it had a subsidiary there. It said the Texas court found that the presence of that subsidiary could be relevant to the case, and it balanced the relevant factors, considered them, and denied the motion to transfer. So all of the arguments that were made in connection with forum shopping, the alleged forum shopping, were also before the fact Texas court under the motion to transfer. I should say with respect to forum shopping, there's no evidence of forum shopping. Maxell has enforced its patents in Texas routinely. It did not pick Texas because it had lost in some other forum. It picked Texas because Texas is familiar with Maxell. The district judges there are. It has this research facility there. And, of course, plaintiffs have a right to pick their forum. No reason why Maxell couldn't pick Texas.
Counsel, do you agree that the district court applied the incorrect circuit law and federal circuit law should control here?
Well, I think This court has said federal circuit law should control. I agree with my friend that it didn't make any difference. We cite on page 17 of our brief a number of this court's decisions saying the fact that a district court cites regional circuit precedent doesn't matter unless it applied the wrong standard. And I think my friend acknowledged and we explained that the district court applied the same standard that would apply under this court's cases for determining whether the first to file rule applies. And as I said, this court has said that it's appropriate for district court to consider whether to defer the exception question to the first filed forum. And we think there certainly was no abuse of discretion with respect to that.
Would it make a material difference in that the Federal Circuit test doesn't have factors and then an exception, but rather has a holistic standard? So theoretically, if the district court here had applied the Federal Circuit test, it would have gone through the entire analysis. Does that make a difference?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because Future Way talks about deferring, I mean, characterizes things as exceptions and talks about deferring to the first filed forum. So I don't think it makes a difference here. I mean, I think the question is, were all of the arguments considered? And they all were considered.
What, if any, response do you have to opposing counsel's concern about or their argument they think the case should have been stayed in lieu of dismissed without prejudice? Let me point out that. And then also this whole fear that if they want to later then do a DJ, you would say that there is an inability to have like a case or controversy and they wouldn't be able to do such an action in light of dropping those patents against the sister companies.
Yeah, I should say these are all new arguments that don't appear in any of the briefs. So just to respond to them on the fly, I think there's something a little weird about saying it should have been dismissed because, of course, then they wouldn't have been able to appeal. So it should have been stayed. They then wouldn't have been able to appeal. And I think it's pretty unlikely that the district judge, with the proceedings being where they are in Texas, that the idea that if this court were to reverse and say, oh, the case has to proceed in California, that the district judge there is going to ignore the fact that the case in Texas is ready for trial and start proceedings up in California. With respect to this new argument about the case was slimmed down, as this court is aware. Trial judges slim down cases, especially in patent cases. So we weeded out our case. So some of the patents are no longer an issue. Those claims were dismissed with prejudice. If they can show.
Just prejudice?
Without prejudice. I'm sorry. Without prejudice.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
We don't mean to freak out on you, sir, but we thought you were saying something.
Yes,
no,
I understand.
So it's dismissed without prejudice. Is that right? In terms of the slimming down of the case.
Yes. So I think there's a clean slate if they can show with a declaratory judgment action that there's some risk, they can file a new action in California or wherever they want, and try to get a judgment on those patents. But
does your client provide them with a covenant not to sue on those patents?
No, we have not.
And your client's not willing to agree to that right now, are they?
Since these arguments just came up right now and I haven't spoken to my client, no, I don't think we are, Your Honor. I think parties slim down cases all the time. I don't think there's a condition in the trial judges impose that unless you're willing to give up your rights for all time against the defendant.
I'm just trying to help slim it down further.
Well, we'd prefer not to slim it down that much, Your Honor.
Get that.
I think where we are now is, did the district judge abuse her discretion in finding the first to file rule applies? We think no. I think my friend agrees.
Can you go back to like that point that I was raising with opposing counsel about whose law in particular ought to govern these kinds of inquiries? I mean, I understand that at the end of the day, maybe it doesn't matter because maybe if I were even to say it was federal circuit law, I'd probably go with what the Ninth Circuit did here anyway. It looks like a good enough rule to me. But whose law ought to apply in that Biodex Panduit kind of way? Is this an issue that touches upon anything unique to patent law, or is it your rote procedural issue that regional circuits deal with all the time?
You know, Your Honor, I think, again, let me start by saying we don't think it's an issue in this case because we think the standards are the same and they're not disputing that it applies. But to sort of move to the bigger question that Your Honor poses, I think there's a pretty strong argument that this is something that regional circuit law should apply to as the Your Honors were saying, this is an issue that arises in lots of cases where there's a declaratory judgment action on one side and a principal claim on the other. And it's true this is patent law, but courts deal with that question about what to do, first to file, declaratory judgment, how do they overlap, who's a desirable party, come up in all kinds of cases. And so I think
who's a desirable party thing is where I actually think you might be wrong about it being regional circuit law, right? Because the who's a desirable party thing, I mean, it doesn't just turn on traditional agency principles. It might it not turn on some patent law related concepts? Or do you think it's just
I think it's true in any case.
Traditional relatedness principles. So I'm trying to figure it out.
No,
I haven't flushed it through my head. I'm talking about it with you.
I think, Your Honor, you could make that claim about almost any substantive law, right? You could say that who's desirable based on what the substantive claim is, varies based on different substantive law. Here, one of the reasons that we think the Texas is appropriate here is that in the Nexon case, Judge Connolly sort of looked at desirable party and said, well, gee, the manufacturer is the most desirable party because they're going to have the evidence that's most relevant to infringement claims.
Again, by virtue of that last thing you just said, is the reason that I keep sort of in my head pinging on the idea that this might better be a question of federal circuit law. It might not matter at the end of the day. It might be a purely academic exercise that I'm going through in my head. I'm just trying to figure it out.
I think it may be, Your Honor, but I think
regional circuit disputes over this. Like the Ninth Circuit standard, looks good to me. Does the Fifth Circuit do it a whole different way that you're aware of?
I haven't surveyed the law, Your Honor, so I think that generally the circuits are in alignment about the relevant factors. I think when you're drilling down in a particular case, as Your Honor was saying with respect to desirability, necessarily the court is going to have to look at the sort of substantive issues that are going to be joined. Where are the facts? What makes sense? But I wonder whether that's so deep into patent law that couldn't be left to, the regional circuit to determine.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to cover?
No. My friend for forum shopping relies on the VoIP case, and I just want to say that was a case where the plaintiff switched forums after losing twice and went to another forum, and that's why the court found forum shopping. And we don't have anything like those facts here.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir. Counsel, Mr. McPhail, you have a little bit of rebuttal time if you'd like it.
I would just like to clarify that the reason the argument regarding the 388 and the 988 patents and them being dismissed from the Texas case was not raised in the initial briefing is it happened after the briefing. It wasn't something we could have addressed when we first wrote our briefs for this
after
court.
After the opening brief and the reply
brief? And the reply brief, yes, ma'am. It happened last fall. Don't remember the exact date, but it was certainly after the briefing had been submitted in this case.
Are you familiar with what, like a Rule 28J letter? There's a concept here at the Federal Circuit where if there's something that arises after briefing, you can make the court aware of it. In that vein, you also make opposing party aware of it so they don't get blindsided in an argument.
Well, they certainly were aware that it happened. They did it.
But they weren't aware that you were going to make the argument to us today, which kind of puts them at a disadvantage, doesn't it?
Perhaps it does. I didn't think it would have put them in a disadvantage given that they knew these facts as equally as well as I did. I'm not surprising them with anything. This isn't something that came on them from a blind side, but I just think it certainly changed the situation here. It didn't strike me that it was appropriate to address in a letter because it struck me as far more argumentative than simply just informative. And for that, I'll apologize, Your Honor.
No problem. Please continue.
With that, I'll just cede the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Excellent. This case is taken under submission, and I thank both counsel for their arguments.